you know, the fact that you can be as well for democracy while being also anti-imperialist. And this was typically, and also the fact that anti-imperialism is not something that is limited to Western imperialism. Although, obviously, we oppose it, and U.S. imperialism is the most important until today, the other states that are practicing, you know, imperialist policies, Russia, China, etc., and that we oppose them equally.
Good morning, Joseph Daher. How are you doing?
I'm fine, and you? How's everything?
Everything's great.
Okay, good. But remind me when we spoke exactly.
So the first thing that we worked on together was a translation for the Revolutionary Left Current. And then after that, we hosted you as a speaker over Skype with the Marxist Student Union, which I organized at App State.
Okay. Okay, great.
How is your plague experience going?
It was not very pleasant, to tell you honestly, as everyone else, I think. But in Switzerland, we still could, to some extent, go out. But it's just working from all the time, from home all the time with the children. It was not easy at all. And plus, we did not have any kind of diminution of work. I mean, my courses continued, and my other works, related jobs, continued completely. So it was quite complicated, yeah. But alhamdulillah, it went well. Can't complain. It's been quite difficult. But it's fine.
Alhamdulillah. So how would you like for me to introduce you for the podcast?
So I'm an international social activist, an academic, wrote two books, one on the Syrian uprising and one on Hezbollah. And the founder of the blog Syria Freedom Forever.
How is it that you came to political work?
The main issue growing up was the Palestinian issue. From Syrian background, we used to hear nearly all the time about the Palestinian issue in the family. It was a very important thing for us, the Palestinian liberation, the struggle that occurred in the past decades. And I started being involved in a BDS campaign in Switzerland following the beginning of the establishment of the BDS movement in 2005. So ended the 2000s in Switzerland, couple of campaigns. Also, I got involved through anti-racist struggles in Switzerland, notably the Islamophobic campaigns for forbidding the minarets of the mosque in Switzerland. So I got involved in this. And after student movement in Britain, and more generally the Middle Eastern and North African uprisings of the end 2010-2011, through my implications, involvement in various countries of the region with campaigns, contacts with various progressive organizations and campaigns, and most particularly, of course, Syria, where I'm originally from.
Yeah. So, aside from the two books that you've written, which are excellent, and I have not read them all the way through, they clearly are incredibly well-researched and detailed, and so I want to give them the attention that they deserve at some point. But aside from those two books, can you recommend a book to our listeners?
Well, it's always hard to recommend only one book, a friend and a comrade of mine just published a book on Syria as well, Yasser Munif, who's based in the U.S. as well, on the Syrian Revolution. But otherwise, two authors that I think are most needed to be read to understand any kind of dynamics in the region, especially regarding uprising, are Gilbert Achkar and Adam Haniyeh, who have both several books on the uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa.
Do you think that socialism has to be democratic? Is there such a thing as undemocratic socialism?
Well, in my opinion, the socialism that I personally defend must be democratic, otherwise it's not socialist. But unfortunately, the history has shown us that forms of undemocratic, or what used to be called, even though I don't believe was socialism, communism, existed. Yani, former USSR, from various countries that proclaim themselves socialist, even though we believe it's not, but it's unfortunately existed. And even I believe that some still maintain a form of socialism or communism that could be undemocratic, but I don't think this should be the case. I think any kind of leftist or progressive politics are firstly based on the ideas of defending and encouraging the self-organization of the popular classes and the objectives of, you know, struggling for democracy, social justice, equality, secularism, and challenging all forms of oppression. Yeah, it's basically the combination of the defense of democratic and social rights. So if you take out democracy from this, I think it's very problematic. Any kind of revolutionary politics must go from, you know, people self-organizing and resistance from below that must be democratic.
How would you characterize what kind of government the Syrians had prior to the prior to 2011?
Well, just prior to 2011, if we don't go back too much in history, the regime of especially Bashar Assad could be characterized as a patrimonial capitalist and despotic regimes, which actually features been deepened throughout the past years during the war. This is how I would define the Syrian regime prior to 2011. Obviously, there are evolutions since the 1960s when Baas took power. The Baas between the period of 63 to 70 could be understood as other, you know, kind of third worldist movements with forms of state capitalism, while, you know, attacking fractions of the bourgeoisie, especially the feudals or traders linked to foreign markets, etc., while forms of redistribution. And actually, there was a form of right-wing coup by Hafez al-Assad in the 70s, which was a coup against the leftist strands of the Baas. And he started to liberalize the economy, although gradually and the mass neoliberal policies in Syria occurred following the arrival of Bashar al-Assad to power. But at the arrival to power of Hafez al-Assad, there is the building, progressively speaking, of the roots of the current regime, basically a patrimonial regime where the centers of power concentrated in few hands and Hafez al-Assad at the time, the use of sectarianism, the use of racism to divide the people, the division between also various divisions implemented in society, and a very authoritarian and despotic rule established in Syria with Hafez al-Assad.
How did you first find out about the uprisings there? What was your first impression?
Well, I was in contact already with various, leftist milieu from the Middle East and North Africa. I was based at the time between London and Switzerland, And most obviously, when the Syrian uprising started, I supported the protest movement, and throughout the years got more and more involved for various ways, whether it be from my work and academic work or research work, or more politically with various attempts to organize, you know, leftist campaigns or internationalist campaigns within leftist and democratic milieu in Syria and outside of Syria. Attempts of gathering and supporting a progressive voice within the Syrian revolution.
How would you characterize the driving ideas behind why people took started protesting in 2011?
Well, in Syria, at the beginning of the protest movement, most obviously there were the images of Tahrir Square in Egypt, the fall of Ben Ali in Tunis, the massive protest movement throughout that were spreading throughout the region inspired a lot of Syrians to go out. This does not mean that there wasn't, you know, the conditions within Syria, the absence of democracy, the absence of social justice and economic development, that also pushed the people in the street in seeking, you know, more forms of democratic rule and forms of social justice and dignity. So basically Syrians, although each, you know, obviously each uprising has its own specifics, there were common trends throughout the region for, you know, democracy, for social justice, for forms of dignity and forms also of what we could call national sovereignty from below, you know, challenging all forms of foreign powers, so forms of self-determination. So these kind of different aspects were present in the protest movement in Syria at its beginning, and I think it's important to remind everyone this, especially that now most of the medias are concentrated, especially since 2013, on the military confrontations, the various foreign intervention, but Syria had a strong, you know, protest movement from below. You had forms of dual power, in the meaning attempts to reach forms of dual power, meaning challenging the center of power because the state disappeared from certain areas. So people start to organize from below, from local councils, from local coordination committees to self-manage themselves. There's a whole history, interesting to talk about again, because it's partially forgotten. On this note, actually, if I may use this interview to invite people to participate in the Syrian webinar that we've been organizing, a couple of supporters of the Syrian revolution, whether Syrians or not, that are on the net. We just started last week on Haymarket with a couple of speakers, and it's really kind of a webinar going through the Syrian revolution with 12 sessions with various topics. And the next session is on next Saturday. So each Saturday and a couple of other sessions. And really in the perspective of reviewing the Syrian revolution from a history from below.
I'll post a link to it in the transcript.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Or at least on my Facebook page, because the interview will come out sometime in late July, I think. But
okay.
Have you seen this wonderful book, Les Passeurs de Livre de Daraya, by Delphine Minuit?
I have it at home. I read a piece of it, but not the whole book. But yes, indeed.
I mean, it's a fascinating window into the intellectual life and the discussion that was going on amongst people in Daraya under siege. I was struck by the fact that they had a small, I don't want to say cult, but they had a small group that was incredibly enthusiastic for the 7 habits of highly effective people.
Yes, indeed. Daraya had even a story from prior 2011 from a group of people organizing first on around, if you want, Sheikh, that inspired kind of a reformist trend and tackling kind of anti-corruption issues in Syria, but also opposing the war on Iraq in 2003. And they went in the streets demonstrating for this issue and got actually arrested by the security services. Although Syria officially opposed the war in Iraq by the U.S. So, no, they had a very important democratic experience that was actually had, you know, it's that was used at the beginning of the uprising in 2011.
I just love the picture of these people under constant bombardment daily. People they know are dying, and they're committed to self-help, essentially. I just love that so much.
Indeed, they were committed to self-help, but also proposing, suggesting, you know, kind of an alternative, a democratic alternative that is inclusive. And it's also an experience that is important to put forward to show that also that people that take some, you know, some, if you want, their political ideas come from religion, but on a progressive perspective, because very often, especially when you come, we speak about the Islamic religion, everything that necessarily comes from Islam is necessarily negative, or perceived as such, and we can see that no, that obviously you have Islamic fundamentalist movement, basically right-wing extreme forces, but you could have also a perspective or an understanding of the region that can be inclusive and proposing, suggesting progress, and in some form of democratic alternative in society. So this also was an experience interesting to take into account on this basis, I believe.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's really weird that in the West, we have all of these progressive religious traditions that we recognize, things like liberation theology, things like the socialist Anglican priests in England who helped build the Labour Party. And somehow it strikes us as odd that there would be similar things from an Islamic point of view, but it's the most natural thing imaginable, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. And it shows you also that ideas are not isolated from the world we live in. And the particular period, especially you mentioning following the Second World War, or even prior, you had a strong, labor movement, leftist ideas, etc., much stronger than now. And obviously, and throughout, even after in the 60s, 70s, especially if we look at the liberation theology that played in South America and a very important role in challenging and in struggling against authoritarian regimes. I mean, it was a particular milieu in which leftist ideas were much more spread, I would say, than today. And obviously, today, just as we have the rise of right-wing or fascistic movements, unfortunately, to have kind of from religion and progressive movement is a bit more difficult.
I think that's right, yeah. So, why did the regime react to the protests the way it did?
This has been actually, this question reminds me of longer debates prior to 2011 on the possibility or not of the regime of reforming. And I don't believe this regime can be reformed at all. It's a patrimonial despotic regime in which you have nearly a concentration of powers in a very small group concentrated within the presidential palace and within Assad and its allies. And if a possible process of reform would start, it would mean that per se the end of this regime. And contrary to other, I would say, and actually the fact that having patrimonial regime in the Middle East and North Africa is more the rule than the exception, unfortunately, where you have kind of privatization nearly of the states by particular families. If you look at the Gulf monarchies, or Libya at the time of Gaddafi, etc., these regimes are much less the opening for example, having the head fallen, but the regime stay is much less possible because the head is basically completely linked to the regime, contrary to, for example, Mubarak in Egypt or Ben Ali in Tunis, where you could get rid of the head without getting rid of the regime, which is much more difficult in the majority of the Middle Eastern countries in this perspective. So therefore, the main instrument to oppose people protesting and the fact that the Syrian regime was increasingly losing its passive hegemony that was present prior to 2011 was violence. Violence because it lost this passive hegemony in society. And because not even, you know, the fact of demanding reforms is acceptable. So any kind of dissent was repressed violently. And one of the lessons, if you want, from a lot of the Syrian heads of the security services while looking at Tunis and Egypt in the past in the weeks prior to the beginning of the uprising, Syria said that the problem in Tunis and Egypt is that they did not repress in a matter that was enough. So full violence was needed.
So recently we had a large wave of protests, and we saw that William Barr, the Attorney General, had seemed to have his own unmarked security forces, and it really reminded me of the way there were, you know, half a dozen different internal security and intelligence groups within Syria. And it was always a question to me just how centralized the state really was. But then the if you read Sam Dogger, he talks about how the French were trying to convince Talas, was it Maher Talas? It was Mustafa Talas' son, to maybe take over. And what do you make of that plan? Was that something that could have happened?
Well, the various Western powers, including the U.S., had this objective of basically what they wanted to do, because this was the main essence of Hira, of the failure of U.S. and British intervention in Iraq, basically saying you should at all costs possible not have the objective of overthrowing the regime, but just having superficial changes at its top. And therefore favoring the arrival of someone like, as you were mentioning, Plas, Manaf Plas, who was dealing with, I think was in charge of the Republican Guard, or I don't remember exactly the name, to replace Bashar al-Assad, like, or to have another, actually, Alawi general taking power instead of Bashar al-Assad and its family, in order to maintain the structure of the regime as it is. This was a complete failure by the various Western forces, and it did not work out, actually. But it showed also the way that the Western powers, but not only the Western powers, regional regimes as well, saw a radical change from below with democratic and social justice features as a threat to their interests. And it could show, it expand as well, the uprisings throughout the region. Because we've seen at the beginning of the uprising, a victory in one country was very often, you know, a push or an encouragement for other countries to continue their protest movement, etc.
Our government just put out the Caesar Act. It's a series of sanctions on the Syrian regime, and there's a white paper from the Center for Global Policy, and in their executive summary, this is their suggestion or their recommendation. They say, quote, "The escalation of economic pressure on the government through the imposition of the Caesar Act this month will hinder cronies profiteering, but also exacerbate the economic hardship Syrian civilians are facing. U.S. policymakers should present the Syrian leadership and its backers with steps short of regime change that could elicit a reduction in external economic pressures." What's your evaluation of that particular plan or that particular idea as a course of action?
Well, I wrote a piece at the beginning of the year, I think it was in February, around the Caesar Act, but basically these are my main ideas. So basically, the Caesar Act is a new escalation of sanctions against Syria, most especially since 2011. And the main characteristic of Caesar Act is basically now put Syria in a similar situation nearly as Iran, Cuba, by having secondary and tertiary sanctions, by hitting anybody that would help nearly in direct or indirect ways the Syrian government and its institutions or its allies in Syria or persons that are targeted. While the Caesar Act proclaims that it wants to, through this kind of sets of sanctions, achieve human rights or the stopping of the offensive of Assad regimes on Idlib or prevent a reconstruction that would benefit the same regime or wanting to know the faith of the same political prisoners and other similar demands, which no one, I think, can oppose, basically. if these kind of demands would be achieved, this would be a very important step forward for Syrian democrats and progressive, and to achieve some forms of justice and to prevent a reconstruction that is not at all, maybe we can talk about it later, occurring in Syria, but to consolidate, if you want, kind of demographic and socioeconomic change within Syria and consolidate the patrimonial power of the regime. When this is said, no one can deny that the sanctions by the U.S., let's first of all say that we doubt that the U.S. want to reach, you know, any sign of respect of human rights in the world or in Syria, as its own policies show this, even in the current protest movement in the U.S. around Black Lives Matter or its foreign policy. It's obviously to reach, this is a sanction, a new way to reach some political interest through putting pressure on Syria and its allies, Iran and Russia. Secondly, we cannot deny that the Syria sanction will obviously participate in harming the Syrian civilians in the country. It will deepen the socioeconomic problems of the various economic problems. But this being said, we should not fall as well in the discourse and the propaganda of the regime that is saying basically the sanctions are the main reasons for the socioeconomic crisis in Syria. This is not the case. The first responsible for this situation is the Syrian regime because of its war on the Syrian people, its destructive policies, and its economic policies rooted in neoliberal policies, and it has actually deepened neoliberal policies throughout the war, using it as an opportunity. But CISA Act will definitely harm Syrian civilians, and the logic behind the sanctions, that thinking you apply more sanctions, people will protest more, is not mechanical. And actually, throughout history, it didn't show this way. One of the examples, obviously, Iraq, 1991-2003, putting increasing sanctions on a country, to expecting its people to raise against this is not mechanical. Plus, it forgets that very often people did not wait for sanctions to raise against its own regimes. For example, the U.S. have often used the example of the latest demonstrations in Iran to say, so you see, the people are protesting against the Iranian regime. It's forgetting that in the past, 20 years, nearly every year, every year and a half, and 2 years, you have massive protest movement in Iran. More than this, the Syrian regime will not fundamentally change its political its policies because of these sanctions. Even the networks of crony capitalism that is linked to the regime will not be, facing deep problems with these sanctions. They won't be able, obviously, to make many deals outside of Syria. But when it comes to internal, being benefiting from a particular state contracts or the privatization policies, this will continue. They will also benefit on the smuggling trade or smuggling different smuggling businesses. So they won't feel per se the sanctions. And the CISA Act continued, deepen the whole incertitude around Syria when dealing with Syria. Not, I'm talking about businesses, but also INGOs and NGOs on the humanitarian field. A lot of them have been complaining about the consequences of the sanctions, whether regarding, financial transactions from bank account to bank account, for example, from Europe to Turkey or to Turkey to within liberated areas of Syria, or for INGOs within Syria. They've been facing increasing problems. And the CISA sanctions just deepen this kind of problem, what we call basically the chilling effect. Just as CISA sanction targets, for example, gas and oil production or exploration. Today, people in Syria are lacking both. So anyone wanting to basically, any company wanting to increase the production of oil or gas in Syria might be targeted. So what is that? If you import gas or oil, you also target it. So it has direct consequences on the economy. Productive sectors of the economy are in need of particular products, whether being oil derivatives and others. Not all people living in Syria today are loyalists. A lot of criticism has been coming within Syria from different sectors of society to criticize actually the Syrian government because of its clientelist, authoritarian, and bad economic policies. So, I mean, I personally is in favor of, you know, sanctions targeting personalities, individuals, particular military institutions because of the need to reach accountability and human rights, etc. But I'm not in favor of these kind of general sanctions, which will harm most the Syrian people at a very high cost. While historically speaking, if you look at sanctions, it never reached really its objectives. Very often, people talk about South Africa to see about the success of sanctions. Actually, it was not the success of sanctions that made partly an end to the apartheid regime in South Africa. Firstly, because most of the sanctions by Western states were only imposed at the end of the 80s after decades of and years of international solidarity by groups, by leftists and others. But moreover, it was the resistance of the South African, the black South Africans, especially against this apartheid regime that put an end to the apartheid regime, and it was not the sanctions per se. After, I won't talk about what occurred after, but it just pointing to the fact that the main important issue today is not that sanctions will achieve, you know, accountability, human rights. Syria. This does not mean again that we shouldn't do anything against the Syrian regime, but we have to think about the tools how to resist against this regime. And one other aspect I would say is that the sanctions, Caesar Act especially, might increase the gap between, you know, Syrians outside of the country and within the country. Because also we have a responsibility by being outside of the country by saying, listen, especially for the ones that support fully the Caesar Act without taking into account the lives of civilians and how within the country, how would they achieve the kind of objective? And it's a threat for me to increase the gap between Syrians from the inside and outside. To some extent, partly during, you know, Iraq wars prior to 2003. And I think we should always be careful about the actions, obviously, of the U.S. and even the way the thing was framed within a particular policy within the military program of the U.S., we should be careful. And the problem is also that everything is dependent on the president of the U.S., who will decide what, etc. But obviously, also, we cannot deny that preventing, you know, Iranian and Russian companies, especially most of them are linked to their own ruling class, benefiting from the spoils of war, it's not something I'm going to oppose, basically. Or a reconstruction based, as I explained before and mentioned, on the consolidation of the regime power benefit and consolidating demographic and socioeconomic change.
Yeah. And when I was listening to you, it's true. When they put sanctions on a country, they expect that those sanctions will cause a protest movement that will threaten the regime and influence its behavior. But it's a bit mechanical, right? Like, I have the same problem when U.S. leftists talk about the Syrian revolution and they say, well, you know, it was caused by climate change and they had a couple of bad crop yields. But like, no, it was caused by people who had ideas and wanted something different in their lives, right?
No, and plus the climate change aspect and the drought about, especially between 2006 and 2008, the effects were deepened by the corrupt and neoliberal policies of the Syrian regime, especially abandoning any kind of support increasingly to agricultural peasants throughout the 2000s, and a couple of laws that actually favor big landowners against peasants and agricultural workers. So it's not actually, you know, opposing this kind of these elements. And you're right, obviously, people had ideas, etc. But it's not opposing them. It's, I would say, it's dialectical. They are linked. We cannot separate them. Just as climate change in Syria had some obviously effects, but that were much deepened by the fact of these neoliberal policies and policies favoring big landowners against agricultural peasants or workforce.
So here in America, for a variety of reasons, the U.S. left has found it quite natural to express solidarity with the Kurdish movement. They didn't find the same sort of generosity towards the Syrian opposition, unfortunately. But we would be remiss not to mention the Kurdish struggle and its relationship to the Syrian opposition. Why was it, do you think, that the SNC and the PYD ended up not making common cause against Assad?
Well, so the SNC is the Syrian National Council. Sorry, that was the main opposition in exile that was established in Istanbul or in Turkey in 2011, October, November 2011. That was dominated by liberal and liberal elements in the Muslim Brotherhood and allies of the Muslim Brotherhood within it. And the PYD is basically the sister branch of the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Movement from Turkey, of its founder, Öcalan. Well, I think there are various reasons for this. First of all, the SNC was very much influenced since the beginning by the fact that one of its main sponsors were Turkey. And even though they were composed of Kurds, a lot of Kurds started to leave throughout 2012, because the SNC, and this is a position, this is a problem that is actually predates 2011, is that large sections of the Syrian opposition, the Syrian Arab opposition, even amongst the leftists, refused the issue of self-determination of the Kurdish people. And when we say issue of the self-determination of Kurdish people, it means separation, meaning, and it's Kurdish people, Kurdish people in Syria deciding of their own future. And most, and the quasi totality of the Kurdish political parties, including the PYD, are asking basically for federalism, or it has also taken sometimes the terms of decentralization, a federal democratic secular state in Syria. And this has been refused by the Syrian Arab opposition. And in many aspects, there's an inherited since the establishment of the Syrian modern state in 1946, since the independence, of a refusal of this issue of the Kurdish struggle. And there's decades of oppression against the Kurdish people, structural racism against Kurdish people. We shouldn't forget that there was periods of colonization of certain areas of the northeast by the Syrian governments, even prior to actually, the idea was launched in 1961, so prior to the arrival of the Ba'ath Party. And there were other forms of repression prior to the Ba'ath Party of Kurdish groups. And this kind of, unfortunately, problems reappeared with the Syrian uprising. So the SNC refused any kind of talking about decentralization, taking into account Kurdish demands, etc. And this has been pursued even worsening throughout the uprising, the link between the various group in exile after the SNC, the ETILAV, the coalition, came increasingly closer to Turkey, and even they supported the Turkish invasion of Afrin, which was a Kurdish majority inhabited areas in 2019, causing huge violations of human rights, displacement of population, and continuous violation of human rights until today. So this is one thing, and obviously I put the biggest responsibility on the same Arab opposition, because it's the majority. They have a particular responsibility to, for equality, to provide an alternative to the same regime that is not similar regarding the Kurdish issue. The same regime is also completely opposed to any kind of Syrian Kurdish self-determination. And it's the responsibility of the majority to guarantee these kind of rights against the ethnic minority of Kurds. While this being said, and I think this is very important, especially among Syrians, to acknowledge this issue, the PYD must have a critical look at its behavior, political trajectory since 2011. So at the beginning of 2011, PYD was far from being the main Kurdish political party in Syria. Quite far from it, but it was allowed by the regime. It was prior to 2011, actually, historically speaking, if you come back to the 70s and 80s, the Syrian Assad regime, Hafez al-Assad, used Kurdish political parties for foreign policies. For example, it helped some Iraqi Kurdish political parties against Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. It did a similar thing in helping sometimes the PKK in the 80s and 90s against the Turkish regime in itself. But this changed, especially at the beginning of 2000, the arrival of Bashar al-Assad and the end of the supporting these kind of Kurdish political parties for various kind of reasons, and they were repressed. And if we remember the 2004 uprising in Syria, that started in Qamishli, but spread to other Kurdish areas of Syria, Kurdish majority inhabited areas, they were not supported by the vast majority of the Syrian opposition. So this to make a bit of history of the Syrian Kurdish struggle in Syria. At the beginning of the uprising, basically, PYD was led by the Syrian regime to come back progressively and to build its forces to control, basically, it was kind of an agreement without being coalition or alliance, to control the Kurdish streets in Syria. And the Syrian regime could not fight on all sides. While the Kurdish street in Syria participates since the first day of the uprising, in Qamishli, Amuda, the Kurdish neighborhoods of Aleppo, etc. And after what happened, it's that between 2012 and 2016, as the regime could not fight, the Syrian regime could not fight on different directions, it led the PYD to build, basically, its kind of autonomous government or form what it called a self-administration, and that was also opposed. PYD was opposed to the opposition in exile, the Syrian Arab opposition in exile, because of its links with Turkey and because it was directed by Muslim Brotherhood and its opposition to the Kurdish issue. This does not prevent, at some periods, some forms of opposition between, of collaboration between these two actors. But more generally, it was the PYD was opposed as well to the Syrian regime, to the opposition, but more to the opposition at this point. And the Syrian regime let the PYD basically build its own institutions, etc. But what happened, and this I wrote since 2014, as the Syrian revolution will be defeated by the Assad regime, the Assad regime will look in direction of the Kurdish majority inhabited areas controlled by the PYD to try to recontrol them. And today we're seeing very clearly that the Syrian regime is refusing any kind of demands by the PYD and the Syrian Democratic Forces, which the PYD is the key political force of federalism, of forms of decentralization. And actually, the regime and its propaganda is very much attacking very often the PYD as a Kurdish separatist force, non-national, a tool of U.S. Imperialism. And one of the issues also was PYD throughout the uprising, especially in the beginning, its authoritarian behavior against other Kurdish political parties for various reasons. But, I mean, this said, the PYD and the Syrian Democratic Forces have been have also achieved some successes that cannot be denied in the uprising. I think the inclusion and participation of women in various institutions and its participation in various issues of society, equality, forms of secularism, inclusion to some extent of various population in institutions are things that we cannot deny, and the dynamic they created and the fact that, you know, an oppressed ethnic minority are able to some extent self-manage itself is something that any kind of leftist should support. So a critical outlook of the experience of PYD, but today as a massive force within Syria is the most probably the force that suggested most a more inclusive outlook. Plus, today you can see the Syrian Democratic Forces in its armed components, a huge chunk of it, and some say even nearly 50 today of 50% are Arab soldiers.
Wow.
So it's a complex issue, but basically it's a complex issue. But I think the key issue is saying basically we should support the self-determination of the Kurdish people in Syria and throughout the region. And we can see that as soon as there's a willingness to change, if you want, this kind of political map, we witnessed this in the Iraqi referendum a couple of years ago, all the states of the region coalesced to oppose this, and even international actors. In the case of the PYD, it's absolutely similar. So we could see, for example, in the future, a form of coming back to a form of the Adana agreement from 1998, when Turkey and Syria made an agreement basically to say we can have a security coordination to hit Kurdish political parties, both especially in PYD. This might be coming back in the future. And that one other thing to say is that while tactical collaboration with the U.S., as it happened, could be a solution in particular events, for example, in Kobani in 2014 when they were facing, you know, extermination by Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, the mistake, I think, was part of the leadership of the PYD was believing that they could transform this tactical collaboration, a particular event, into a strategic relation. And that has been witnessed as a mistake because the U.S. is not at all a friend of the Kurds historically, as we've seen. And they might unfortunately abandon, not unfortunately, but they might most probably abandon once more the PYD in a new offensive ordered from the Turks or from the same regime backed by Russia. So many threats are on today what has been called Rojava, etc. On this last point, maybe it's important to say that there's currently talks and to unite the various Kurdish political forces that were rivaled between the PYD and the forces that were closer, if you want, to the Barzani trend of Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdish National Council, to unite them against exactly the various external threats that are facing the Syrian Kurds more generally.
Does that mean Iran?
Actually, Iran is very much opposed to the branch of the PKK in Iran and to any kind of self-determination of the Kurdish people. Actually, Iran played a humongous role to defeat the Iraqi Kurdish referendum a couple of years ago, and Qasem Soleimani, especially its Iraqi Shia fundamentalist forces, taking over some areas of Sulaimaniyye, for example. Oh no, sorry, Kirkuk, the city of Kirkuk, important in oil. You can also see that Turkey lately has been bombing once again the Kandil mountains in Iraqi Kurdistan against PKK, etc. Or just the repression of Turkey in this past few years, but historically speaking, against the let's say majority HDP party.
Yeah. Speaking of Iran, there's a economic crisis going on there as well, and I was hoping you could maybe speak to the background of Iran's support for Hezbollah and Hamas and how that affected their different positions regarding the Syrian opposition and how that might be evolving.
Well, we must be clear that Iran has never been an actor that is willing to see the liberation and emancipation of the people of the region. It's an authoritarian, despotic regime, reactionary, and it has been increasingly playing, after the 2003 Iraq war, an expanding role in the region. In Iraq, through the support of various Iraqi Shia fundamentalist parties that have been governing with actually the collaboration of the U.S. Iran and U.S. have been basically, after 2003, very often collaborating when it came to the U.S. Ruling Iraq. And Iran has, opposed the latest Iraqi uprising or the Lebanese uprising because it challenged basically its geopolitical interest in the region. And when it came to Syria, the main object of interest for Syria, for Iran, it was maintaining Syria as its main geopolitical ally in the region and allowing the continuation of transit of weapons to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is basically in Lebanon the most important success of the export of the Islamic Revolution of Iran in the 80s to the region. Hezbollah has grown into the most important political force in Lebanon and into a regional force, as we can see its intervention in Lebanon, in Syria, throughout the war on the side of the Assad regime to repress any kind of form of opposition, while it also played an increasing role, partly, even though relatively speaking, small in Yemen by sending few military engineers and technicians, and in Iraq as well, playing quite an important role within some of its cadres in the training and managing some of the forces of the Shia Islamic fundamentalist militias of the popular mobilization forces, also known as the Hashd al-Sha'bi. So for Iran, the main interest was regarding Syria, maintaining Syria as a geopolitical ally, especially Bashar Assad, who has deepened its relationship with Iran since arriving to power, and with Hezbollah. While Hafez Assad used Hezbollah as a tool in the negotiation to pressure Israel to reach a peace agreement, Assad deepened its relationship with Hezbollah, meeting a couple of times Hassan. While Hafez Assad, I think, never met Hassan Nasrallah, for example. So this was the main interest of Iran, but Iran is not different to the other authoritarian and despotic regimes regarding the region, maintaining authoritarian and despotic rule throughout the region when it comes to Saudi Arabia, Emirates, Turkey, Qatar, etc. They don't want below into a with a democratic and social justice perspective. They all are afraid of this.
But how can our listeners get involved? What can we do to help?
Well, I think even though we entered a new, first of all, we are in a new decade, obviously, but not more seriously, I think there are still ways to help the Syrian revolution. That is, like all the other revolutionary processes in the region, long-term revolutionary processes. So it will go through, ups and downs. Obviously, today we're more into the down. But as we witnessed in the past few weeks, there have been, important demonstrations in Sweda and Daraa, even in a locality, in a town, a city, close to the Damascus capital that is called Jaramana. And forms of dissent have increased in Syria, especially regarding, you know, socioeconomic problems. So, I'm saying this to go into your direction. What can be done, and even now, despite the catastrophic situation of the Syrian people. First of all, I think it's important to keep the memory of the resistance from below, of the Syrian uprising, that is often forgotten. The roots of this uprising and how it's part of the revolutionary processes of this region. This is something I think it's important because the narrative of Syria has increasingly, in these past few years, denied this kind of this dynamic that was part of the region. Uprising, resistance from below, etc., and not limit Syria, you know, to Syrian problems or geopolitical issues or etc. And in this perspective, yeah, making this memory alive of the beginning of the protest and using this memory to build future resistance, I think, is very important. At the same time, we should continue to pressure, I think, the Syria when it comes to human rights and accountability, pressuring you know, personalities, individuals of the Syrian regime to be threatened by prosecutions, etc. We can see that a couple of cases have started to begin, for example, in Germany, targeting former personalities of the regime that have committed crimes and tortures, etc. Also, we can see that these threats could, you know, have even in a perspective in the future be helpful when we see that the case of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir being threatened to be sent and normally should be sent to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. So I think these are things important to continue to pressure regarding human rights and helping, you know, internationalists, the role also of internationalists is helping, you know, Syrians to organize outside. And this is where we can see an exile or facing difficult situation. And there, this is, I think, we can see the link, basically the slogan I repeat all the time, our destinies are linked, because the struggles of the Syrian people in exile countries are also the causes of the people living in these countries regarding the democratic rights, because very often the first to be targeted when it comes to democratic rights are refugees and foreigners. But this is only a start to attack democratic rights in general in Syria. Democratic rights in general in these countries. And we can see that with the deepening of neoliberal policies throughout the world, there's also been, because it comes together, authoritarian policies being implemented Actually, at the end of the 2019, we've witnessed, you know, throughout the world, various protest movements and uprising boom because of the lack of democracy and increasing inequality in terms of social justice, citizenship, etc. So we can build on this. And this is our, including the issues of refugees and foreigners and struggling against racism, struggling against Islamophobia, struggling against, you know, this so-called fight against terrorism, that are ways to only attack democratic fights are important. And this is why I say our destinies are linked. So putting these kind of struggles together, learning also from the revolutionary experiences from a lot of Syrian in exiles who've been protesters or activists in these countries. So it's not only, it's a two-way, I think. It's a two-way in that both of us can help each other for indeed improving our society and prevent any kind, also, you know, the role of various states and especially in the West of helping authoritarian regimes in the Middle East is also something that we should target, and without forgetting, obviously, the issue of Palestine as well, and supporting, you know, boycott, disinvestment, sanction campaigns against Israel and preventing, you know, the organization of apartheid, fighting against all of, I think all these kinds of things are linked. If it makes
sense. That's interesting. I'm not sure that the recent protests in the United States from the inside, from within the United States, I'm not sure that they're understood as a struggle for democratic rights. Although I would argue that clearly they are. And I think that a lot of people, particularly on the socialist left, groups like the PSL, the Party for Socialist Liberation, who also serve as the leadership of the Answer Coalition, they rather supported Bashar al-Assad, I don't think because they accepted him as a lesser evil, so to speak, as someone that was resisting Israel, but because they really do believe in an authoritarian form of socialism. And so that question to me is very much linked to this quote from Yassin Hajj al-Saleh when he says that before helping Syrians or showing solidarity with Syrians, the mainstream Western left needs to help themselves. And so in a large degree, this podcast is an attempt to answer that call. But I was curious how you read that particular statement. And when you read that statement, what kind of ideas does it come up to you as constructive, as I would say, supportive criticism of the U.S. left, for instance?
Well, first of all, I think it's not only a problem in the West, and this is, I think, something that we should also acknowledge coming from the Middle East, that you have a lot of leftist parties that are also, especially from rooted in Stalinian or Maoist perspective, supporting, you know, authoritarian regimes, and they have a particular, you know, obviously authoritarian perspective. So it's something not prior to, and I wouldn't homogenize the whole Western left, because we've seen a lot of also sectors of the left to assist certain revolutionaries and being there from the first days. So not contradicting, but saying it's a more kind of a universal problem, unfortunately, that I think is rooted in the fact of lacking of thinking that, you know, changes from below, a self-organization from below is a possibility and a necessity, a necessary alternative to be built. I mean, that's not only how you reach your objective, how you reach your objective is also important because it will influence your objectives. So the means that you use are important because it will influence the end. So if I had any kind of criticism, is the fact that, you know, leftist abandoning, whether in the West, whether in the Middle East or throughout the world, abandoning this perspective of changes from below, or also, for example, opposing, you know, the fact that you can be as well for democracy while being also anti-imperialist. And this was typically, and also the fact that anti-imperialism is not something that is limited to Western imperialism. Although obviously we oppose it, and U.S. imperialism is the most important until today, there are other states that are practicing, you know, imperialist policies, such as Russia, China, etc., and that we oppose them equally. Just as that it's not sufficient to have a president or a dictator saying I am against the U.S. to be anti-imperialist. Otherwise, we have to consider Osama bin Laden as a true anti-imperialist. I don't believe this is it. And other issues would be also to oppose, you know, forms of that we should completely separate oppression and exploitation while they go together. And these kinds of find, I think, completely linked to the Syrian revolution, all these issues. And this would be the most important, if you want, criticism I would put forward, that we need to rebuild an internationalist left that takes into account this kind of consideration, that believes that our main boussole, or our main, how do we decide, if you want, basically, how to support, etc., is the people in struggle. This is the most important for democracy, social justice, and equality. And for a true, if you want, meaning of socialism, that is democratic, I would say this is our main objective. And there's a lot of work, especially after the pandemic, you know, the attacks throughout the world by right-wing fascistic groups, but not only, but also the neoliberal elites, that want to attack, you know, working class people, popular classes, oppressed people, and deepen any kind of forms of authoritarianism and neoliberal policy. So lots of work.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot there. And given how important America is in the world, I think it's fair. Then I think one of the things that Americans should be doing is thinking about the way that our politics impacts people living in Europe and people living in the Middle East, and being open and listening to those people and what they would like to see. So in that spirit, if you could vote for in the presidential elections in 2020, who would you vote for?
No one. I mean, I don't believe that the Democrats or the Republicans are any kind of options. They've been sharing power and practicing similar policies. I can understand people wanting to have Trump out at any price, but when we can see what is saying Joe Biden, is definitely. Obviously, there can be a lot of discussion on tactical vote, the most important is being out of Trump. But I think that the main issue today is how to support the Black Lives Matter that you were mentioning before, that I think is not only about, you know, anti-racism. It's about they're challenging the whole structure of power in the U.S. And I think it's a class a struggle, challenging the racist and capitalist space in the U.S. and challenging the society as a whole, when you see the defunding movement, etc. And in this perspective, the Democrats or the Republicans are not hearing what the most radical, you know, most important sections of the Black Lives Matter movement is putting forward. So, and again, I'm not going to say that I'm going to have huge differences regarding tactical issue, but the most important is how to build on Black Lives Matter, how to build an alternative that can fully present, you know, a resistance to any future U.S. Government that is rooted, historically speaking, in racism and is ready to have new neoliberal policies.
Wonderful. So we've reached the end of our time. So Joseph Dauher, I want to thank you so much for the interview. You've been wonderful.
No, thank you to you.
A Democratic Socialist Almanac is a podcast exploring all things relevant to socialism today, from the latest scholarship regarding the socialist tradition to socialist reflections on our current moment and where to go from there. Follow us on Facebook, subscribe where you get your podcasts, and support us on Patreon.